Hello, this is Mike Harbath with Revenue Rocket and another Shoot the Moon podcast for this week in November of 2020. This week we're going to talk about working capital. So as we talk about working capital, we get a lot of questions when we're working on an M&A transaction about how to calculate excess working capital and what should the working capital harvest look like. I'm fortunate to be here with my partner, Ryan Barnett. And Ryan, over to you.
Hey, good morning, Mike. This is something that comes up in every deal, and it's one of the sticking points and one of the most important things to think about early and often as you start to look at a deal if you're a seller. So, Mike, I just want to ask the easiest question. What is working capital? Can you define that for me?
Sure. So technically, working capital is the amount of money that you have to operate the business. As you know, there's as a business owner or someone who's managing an IT services company, you need a certain amount of liquidity to operate your business. You need to be able to pay your people as payroll. You need to be able to pay trade payables. You need to be able to have access to cash flow in order to pay those bills. And, you know, some of you that have had a few speed bumps through COVID know that, your working capital and your cash flow may have been disrupted. Generally, when we calculate working capital, excess working capital is calculated as a function of, subtracting current liabilities from current assets. That working capital ratio, oftentimes, if you look at, let's say, current assets equaling current liability, is known as a net working capital of zero, because you need to be able to have that amount of working capital just to operate the business. Now, oftentimes, depending on what you do with your payable accruals, that still might not be enough, in the sense that if you're accruing for things like a month's worth of payroll and all your expenses for a month on the liability side of your ledger, and then you convert those accruals to the actual bill, or you put the bills in, more importantly, at the very basic level when they come in, even though you haven't paid them, then that'll help you have enough money to actually manage the business. Now, the challenge becomes also that, you know, if you look at current assets include cash and receivables. Now, you can't pay your bills with receivables. That's why many of our clients get a accounts receivable line of credit in order to, if for whatever reason they have a client that's a slow pay, they can get the cash and ultimately pay their bills. So I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but I wanted to just set the stage as to what is working capital and why you need it. Ryan?
Just to understand that, Mike, yeah, just to understand that a little better, you mentioned accounts receivable are not considered part of the working capital. Can you go into that a little more?
No. AR and cash are part of working capital. So at least on the asset side of the ledger. So when you think about current assets and then you subtract current liabilities, you know, excess working capital technically is above whatever's above that number. So let's say for nice round numbers, you had receivables of 200,000, you had 100,000 in cash, and you had 100,000 in payables or liabilities associated with the business, current liabilities. This wouldn't include long-term debt. It would just include generally trade payables or current obligations that you have to meet. In that example, the combination of cash and receivables would be higher than that of your liabilities, right? So in that case, if you had an excess amount of value in the asset side of the ledger, that would be considered excess working capital and would be eligible for a harvest in an M&A transaction.
So, sure, that makes more sense. Thanks for clarifying that. When you think about this, it seems like the other side of the equation, or where buyers and sellers come to, oftentimes to the conclusion, it comes to cash-free, debt-free. It's a can you define that? Am I correct in that assumption that oftentimes that's part of the direction that teams go towards?
Right.
That deals go towards, pardon me?
Right. So a lot of financial buyers in particular, private equity firms and other financial buyers like to do cash-free, debt-free in a growing business. However, the challenge with that model is that if you're growing a business quickly, that leaves quite a bit of money on the table as a seller because you'll have an inordinate amount of money caught up in your accounts receivable. So it's not very fair to the seller to do cash-free, debt-free, right? Because the argument by a buyer that's saying that is, hey, we certainly don't want to incur any debts other than trade payables, which I generally agree to take. We don't want any long-term liabilities. Now, regardless of how you calculate excess working capital, there's an assumption that you would have paid off all of your kind of long-term liabilities. Let's say you have a term loan for buying equipment or office furniture, or, you know, whatever it might be, or you have termed out maybe a credit facility to get through some hard times. All of those things, kind of a short-term line of credit. Some people did that during the financial crisis. Others, I suspect, will do it during the COVID. If they had, you know, a big impact from COVID, they may have a long-term sort of a note, if you will. And, or an example of that would be the EIDL loans, the EIDL loans that were given out from the SBA in support of sort of the death disaster funding through COVID. That's considered, you know, kind of a long-term liability. And it's going to be your responsibility as a seller to pay off long-term liabilities no matter what. But oftentimes, buyers will want to do cash-free, debt-free, and they would allow you to harvest whatever cash you have. But then they would ask you to leave your AR behind in order to fund ongoing operations, and they would collect that AR and then pay it. But at a fundamental level, if you're doing that, you are leaving money on the table as a seller in a fast growth IT services company. If you're flat, not really growing quickly, or you don't typically grow quickly, it probably wouldn't matter, right? It probably cash-free, debt-free would probably be fine, particularly if you're managing your AR, your days of sales outstanding, and your AR more normative at, you know, approaching 30 days or less, you certainly would be fine to do cash-free, debt-free. But on the other hand, if you're growing your business, particularly if you're growing your business in double digits, you will leave money on the table doing cash-free, debt-free.
Right, right. That makes it makes a ton of sense. Now, can you help me understand simply how does the calculation of working capital happen in a deal? So is it pegged on some kind of multiple of another number? Is it based on an average of cash on hand? What are some methods that firms use to come up with that number of working capital?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? Now, most small business owners overcapitalize their business on purpose, meaning they leave more cash in it than they need to leave in it. They do that so that they don't have to get into a line of credit or, you know, focus on paying interest in lines of credit to cover slow pay clients or clients that may, you know, just have a policy to pay you slowly. And as a result, you know, you've got to have extra cash on hand. So there's this thing known as a coverage ratio. Coverage ratio has to do with your current assets versus your current liabilities. And many, many small businesses operate at a 2 or 3 to 1 coverage ratio, meaning they have 2 or 3 times the amount of current assets versus current liabilities, sometimes a lot higher, as a way to manage the cash flow in the business. And in a healthy business typically has 2 to 1 or higher coverage ratio of their current assets to current liabilities, which generally means they're in a, you know, pretty good positive cash position almost all the time. Now, it's easy when there's a business downturn or there's difficulties in the business to allow your liabilities to blossom. And as a result, it negatively impacts your coverage ratio and oftentimes may mean that you need to get into a line of credit to get some liquidity in order to pay down those payables or those liabilities to get your coverage ratios in alignment. Now, with coming out of a relatively prosperous period, as we have for the last several years, many clients have a lot of excess cash. And that means that on their balance sheets. And those monies may have been on there for a long time. And because of that, a buyer, particularly a financial buyer, may come to the conclusion or try to come to the conclusion that they want to determine what your average working capital has been over the year and then ask you to leave that money in the business. And that is an inappropriate ask if you've been carrying a lot of excess working capital. Let's say you have a 5-to-1 or 6-to-1 or in some cases 10-to-1 coverage ratio of current assets versus current liabilities because you've been carrying a lot of cash. Now, some businesses are going to do this kind of automatically because of the PPP loans. As these PPP loans are now being forgiven, well, even before they were forgiven, because there was cash put on the balance sheet, yet there was a long-term liability associated with that, with the note from the SBA, suddenly your coverage ratios went up, right? And now as they're being forgiven, your equity will go up on your balance sheet because the liabilities will not, in essence, offset that excess cash. They'll just go away associated with those PPP loans. But these high coverage ratios that companies have, I think you have to be careful as a seller to not allow a buyer to convince you to just leave the average working capital that's been on the balance sheet in the business at sale if you've been overcapitalized. It's important to understand what amount of working capital is required in your business to operate it and to only leave that amount in. And in our opinion, that consists of current assets kind of minus current liabilities plus 1 month's expenses. And depending on how you do your accruals as it relates to those 1 month's expenses, it may or may not involve the full month, meaning if you already accrue for 1 month's payroll, that's already in, right? Some people do that, some people don't. And I don't want to make it confusing. It should really just be current assets minus current liabilities and current liabilities as the whatever the current trade payables are plus 1 month's expenses is reasonable to leave in a business at a sale. Any excess working capital beyond that, whether it be in cash or receivables, should be able to be harvested by a seller and oftentimes is harvested if it's caught in AR in a 90-day true-up. So hopefully that all makes sense. I know this is kind of a complex topic with a lot of moving parts, but it's important as a seller to make sure that you're striking a fair balance with a buyer because the only time you really can harvest excess working capital in your business is when you sell it.
Is there any kind of tax penalty or anything that someone should be worried about, or is there any negativity to harvesting cash in the business? Could that cash be used elsewhere to increase perhaps the value of the business in some other way?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it depends on the structure of the deal. So, generally, if you harvest excess working capital out of the business at a sale, it's treated as ordinary income. And should be treated accordingly. Now, you could argue in a stock deal that is also acquiring excess cash that purchase price, if it accommodates that excess cash, that enhanced purchase price, if you will, would be treated as capital gain. So that could occur. Although I would tell you it's fairly rare to structure a deal as a stock deal in which a purchase price would be quote-unquote higher due to the excess cash on the balance sheet. You know, we've seen it. It does occur, but it is a fairly rare occurrence for a variety of reasons, particularly in a stock deal where a buyer cannot really amortize the purchase price versus in an asset deal where they can amortize the purchase price and would need to call out that the portion of the purchase price associated with the excess cash is what it is, and thus that portion of the deal would be taxed as ordinary income.
Yeah, I see now. Interesting. It certainly is a complex process here. What's the best thing a company can do when entertaining a sale? What things should they start to plan to help this working capital situation?
Well, certainly you need a strong M&A advisor on your side that understands the nuance of calculating and negotiating working capital to your benefit. Your financial advisors, your CPA, your accountant can assist in this area and may be able to handle that negotiation. However, I have seen that most of financial advisors are much more adept at advising you on the tax ramifications for any working capital harvest strategies, but don't necessarily provide a ton of help when it comes to negotiating and optimizing the deal. That's really the role of an M&A advisor. And so having a competent M&A advisor who's working on your behalf in this portion of the negotiation, which generally happens in the definitive agreement, this is post-LOI stage, one of the things that gets negotiated. And frankly, one of the biggest areas that buyers take advantage of sellers in trying to optimize the deal value for themselves is around working capital. So these topics need to be closely managed. And the best way to do that as a seller is to have a competent advisor on your side helping you.
That makes sense. I totally agree with that. That's not really all the questions I got today. Anything else you want to add to the topic, Mike?
No, I guess, you know, as you guys listen to this podcast, if you have specific questions about working capital or working capital approaches, you certainly can email us at info@revenuerocket.com, and we'd be happy to share some of our insights and approaches and things that we've seen work in negotiations around working capital and M&A transactions. You can find some additional information on our blogs and on our website as well. And with that, I think we'll call it a wrap for this week in November 2020. And we wish everyone's hopefully staying healthy and happy. And feel free to tune in next week for next week's podcast on also growth strategies and M&A tactics for IT services companies. Thanks and have a great day.